Welcome to Minority Reports, another amazing, exciting episode we have for you. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh. We have just one of my dearest, dearest friends. I just love him and respect him so much. You have seen this guy on NDTV. He's been a Laugh Factory star for the longest time. My very, very funny friend, Raj Sharma. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. Hello. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, friend. How are you?
I'm doing great now that I am talking to you, so I feel great.
I'm so proud of all the good stuff that you're doing.
Man, I love you for it.
You are a next level hustler.
Oh, like, man.
I admire that. Like, I'm too lazy. So, like, you have drive, which is impressive.
Also known as trauma, but I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all have that. We're South Asians. We grow up, like, traumas. That comes with tea.
It's just part of being brown.
It is. I was just thinking about this the other day when somebody sent me a thing for an escape room. And I was like, if you grew up in an immigrant household, every room was an escape room. Like, you were trying to get the fuck out of that house.
That's
as quick
correct.
As possible.
That is absolutely correct. Now, Raj, I know your background quite well, but we'll let the audience know a little bit about you. I mean, you were born and raised in Dallas.
I was born in Stephenville, Texas, raised in Dallas.
Yep.
Started doing stand up out there in 2002.
Yeah.
And moved out to Los Angeles 2011.
Yeah.
And sort of nice things sort of fell into place very quickly, and we got into the Laugh Factory and the CBS Diversity Showcase, and all kinds of cool shit started to happen.
Yeah.
And, shortly after that, I met you, and we started watching you do your thing and then hustle and get your own shows. And I think I was on the first, I think I hosted the first Minority Reports.
Yes, yes.
At the Belly Room in the Comedy Store.
And that is correct.
I think the last one we did was this art gallery here in Sherman Oaks. And now you've taken it to all the improvs and you're in Vegas now. And like I said, your hustle knows no bounds.
Oh, well, that's very kind of me, man. I appreciate that. I just don't have a life and I'm not married. So that's, you know, there's also that.
Yeah.
Can't.
I mean, you're making good use of your time then. That's good.
Yeah, I'm just trying to do as many things as I can and that I want to do before my time runs out on this planet.
And you do, like, with what you're doing with Minority Reports is pretty spectacular. Like, your lineups, because I follow it. I follow it on all the social media, as the kids say. But your lineups are really, really incredible. It's very female-centric, which I love, because there's such a lack of that in the comedy world. And it's not just geared towards South Asians. You have your Latino night, Latina nights,
That's
and then
right.
you have your Bollywood nights, and then you have just a mix, hodgepodge of that. And I'm lucky enough to get to host those. So,
man,
so proud of you, and so glad that you're doing this. You're giving voices to people that absolutely need them.
Thank you very much. I think that's exactly my intention. I mean, I want the world to know how amazing of a friend and amazing talent you are. So I want the world to know who you are, and just want you to rise to the top.
Look me up on the YouTube.
I mean, listen, Raj Sharma is a legend. I mean, if you don't know Raj Sharma right now, you are doing something wrong with your goddamn life. Get your shit fucking together and type in Raj Sharma right now in your Google.
Yeah, and if you, we were just talking about this the other night. You know Tom Tran, who's a very good friend of ours.
Yes.
And he does this bit on stage where he goes to Celebrity Net Worth.
Okay.
And you type in Tom Tran's name and he has people read it on stage with his Celebrity Net Worth. And so if you look me up on YouTube, don't look me up on Celebrity Net Worth. Because
not yet. You're getting there.
According to Celebrity Net Worth, I'm worth $20 million.
That's amazing.
Which is very, very off by about $25.5 million.
Listen, man, can I just say 25.5? I like how you put the half in there. Because it made all the fucking difference.
I'm negative millions of dollars.
That's what it should be. Listen, you know that in Hollywood, it's all about perception. And the fact
it
that
is,
they
and
think...
That's what and I think that's why a lot of places are like, well, he doesn't need the work.
That's right.
That's... He's got $20 million in the bank. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Celebrity net worth lies.
$25.5 million. Let's
No, they say I'm worth 20. They're off by 25.
$25.5 million. Got it. I mean, you know, for me, it's like when I met you, I had only heard about the great Raj Sharma. And,
it was all smoke and mirrors.
It was, listen, and, you know, it works. make it work, man. That's, you know, you fake it till you make it, man. That's what I'm about, you know, fake it till you make it. I'm trying to fake this whole look thing over here. You should have seen me this morning.
You just need to tell your audience that you're lying. She's actually a white girl named Susan.
It's Becky, actually, but close.
Oh, it's Becky? Okay, yeah, she just dyes her hair and tans.
Becky with the good hair, baby. What's up?
She just dyed her hair tan, learned how to speak Hindi and Urdu. And
just a little bit, you know?
Yeah, just getting by.
Trying to get some of that Silicon Valley money, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what the rich billionaires...
How's Vegas is treating you well?
Vegas has been so fantastic. I honestly wish I had... come here sooner, but I guess this is the time I was meant to be here. So
yeah,
I love Vegas. I love coming here. I feel, you know, I feel like people only think of Vegas in terms of it's the strip, and you know, and that's fine because people just come here to party and stuff, but there's this whole different world outside of the strip, and it's laid back, it's clean, it's nice, it's a lot cheaper than California. I like it. I dig Vegas, man. I really do. And
Are you doing some spots while you're out there? You going up?
Yeah. I go up, I do spots, but I think for this time it was just about, just coming and taming the podcast with you guys. And
didn't you go to a boxing thing recently?
I did.
I didn't realize you were into, like, big into boxing.
Huge boxing fan. Yeah, I don't think we've ever talked about this. Yeah, we've never talked about this. I huge boxing fan. Been following it for well over 15 years. And
wow.
Yeah, just a huge, huge fan. My ex husband and I used to spar. He was an amateur boxer, so he got me into boxing.
Oh wow.
Yeah, he got me into boxing, and we used to. But then he would emotionally beat me up later, so that was really lovely. He's like, this bitch can take a punch in the, but can you take a punch emotionally? She's like,
well, look at you now.
Look at me now. Look at me, all damaged, and just trying to cover this, faking it till I make it.
That's the best kind of comedy. Is she going to tell a joke or put a bullet in her brain? Let's find out.
Exactly. It's like Dancing with the Scars, you know?
That should be a show.
Dancing with the Scars. I do this bit about how ISIS should have a TV show called Dancing with the Scars, and whoever dances their pain, physical pain, gets to get a bar of soap so they can take a shower.
But when ISIS is dancing, is it mandatory that they have the rifle over their head as they dance?
Just like a workout kind of a dance?
Yeah, because if you watch any of their like celebrations, they always have like their AK-47s above their head, and they're just
that's their
go-to move. It's like grab your gun.
That's
because they don't know what to do with their hands.
That's true. That's their kind of like what's that crazy workout that everybody does? CrossFit. That's their CrossFit.
Oh yeah.
The ISIS CrossFit.
Which one's more dangerous, ISIS or CrossFit people?
I'm gonna say it's CrossFit. I think it is.
If somebody can throw a tractor tire at you,
right?
And when did that become a thing?
Like right?
I have been working out. I mean, I was played sports in high school and continued to.
That's right. You played football.
Try to be as athletic. Yeah, try to be as athletic as possible. But
yeah.
I haven't, it wasn't until CrossFit that, like, in my head somewhere was a guy that owned a tractor tire factory. And he was like, fuck it, we're almost out of business. And then the first CrossFit place opened up, obviously somewhere in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know what we need? 4 tractor tires. And he's like, turn the lights back on. We can pay the rent now, because every CrossFit place I go to has a fucking tractor tire.
Dude, I don't fuck with those things. Like, I have physical injuries. Like, I can't mess with that. I have a broken neck.
But you're not a CrossFit person, are you?
I used to be a CrossFit person for the longest time.
Oh, it's a cult, right?
It's a total cult. Honestly, my legs got super strong. I used to leg press about 400 when I started doing CrossFit. Yeah, my legs were like, meh. I used to bench press 120, leg press 400.
Wow.
Yeah. I was pretty... in shape, and now I'm on a seafood diet. I see whatever the fuck I eat. I'm on this mission of I don't give a fuck. I just want to be happy and just eat and smoke and drink and just have a good time.
That's what it should be.
Yeah, right.
That's what it should be about. Yeah, I just, you know what? It's too, life is too fucking short.
Dude, I was just 25. Like, what happened?
You were Jay? Oh, no, no. I remember. I think about it. Here's the thing. I don't know if it's that way with you, but like in my brain, I'm still like 25, 26.
Yeah, yeah.
But my knees are about 92. Yes. So in my head, I'm like, hell yeah, we're going to do this. And then I stand up and everything pops. And I'm like, we should probably sit back down.
Yeah. One of your jokes that you did on stage, which I friggin' loved, was you were like, I threw my back out. I was folding laundry.
And I did.
It's fucking brilliant. Is that an actual thing or is that just a joke?
Every year since I turned 40, something has happened on my birthday or around it. So when I turned 40, 2 days after my 40th birthday, I was sitting on this very couch that I'm on now. Folding laundry, and I took I had a white t-shirt,
yeah,
and I just kind of snapped the wrinkles out of it, and when I did that, somehow I was in the same thing happened to my back that would have happened in a rear end collision. I pulled my back so hard. I remember my wife Claire coming home, and I'm just on the couch laying down.
Wow.
And I was like, I didn't know. As an Indian, you would think I would know what Tiger Bomb was, but I didn't. I had to have the whitest Australian lady in the world
tell you
show
about
me
the
what Tiger Bomb was.
Yeah.
And then 41, I was on the road and I was headlining a club and I was in their condo, and I slipped coming out of the shower and cracked my shin on the toilet.
Jeez, that's painful.
25 minutes before showtime.
Oof.
40. That was 40. 41. 42.
Did you end up doing the show after cracking your shin?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, look at you.
Yeah, I did an hour.
Of your dad was probably going off. It's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was like if you were a doctor, you wouldn't have been in the shower. You wouldn't have been in the toilet.
Or you would have been able to heal yourself if you were a
doctor. Yeah, I was like, I got merch and I can make merch money. Yeah, I'll suffer through this. 42, so I think I broke a finger. 43, bifocals.
What the?
So I've got the bifocals.
Wow, man. I'm getting up there.
And then here's the crazy part, and this is what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
I turned 44 in October last year.
Yeah.
Nothing happened.
Thank God. Let's not jinx that.
That means something's on the horizon.
But that means that your body is just like, we're taking a break for a few years.
Or it's like, you know what? There's a semi about to hit you. So
Jesus, don't say that. God forbid. I don't want that for you.
I mean, I live in Sherman Oaks. Where are semis? Come on.
There are no semis. Please don't come out.
No semis.
Please do not drive to Vegas. There's a shit ton of semis on the road. Please fly.
So how
often
do you make this drive now?
I am here every other week, every 2 weeks. I'm here.
Wow, man.
I love my drives. I love going on long drives. It really clears my head. I get to talk to myself a lot so I don't freak people out. I mean, I just love all of it.
Well, I think we get accustomed to, like, we say long drives. Like, you're like, a long drive. Well, in your case, when you're doing a long drive, you end up in Vegas. Here,
that's right.
You can be in Sherman Oaks, do a really long, you know, hour, two-hour drive, and you're just in Studio City.
That's correct. That is correct. It's like you move, like, 5 centimeters in 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like, that's traffic for you.
I love Waze when it's like estimated time in traffic. I'm like, oh, let's hear it. It's like estimated time in traffic, 47 minutes. I'm like, that's not traffic.
Right? Right?
We're just here now. Let's just all live on the 405.
Hey, man, like, speaking of sitting in painful fucking traffic and trying to get through it. I want to get into this with you. I want to talk about how I feel like as South Asians and also as comedians, I guess, we experience a lot of pain and trauma that we come from, right? So how do you feel like pain and trauma has been a big driving force for you as a comic, and do you get, you know, and being on stage, does that help kind of provide some sort of healing for you to talk about your pain and trauma?
I know for a fact that it does. And you know, we joke about it, especially amongst each other, like when we're, you know, when we are out and, you know, grabbing a drink somewhere or sitting down, like we talk about it, we joke about it.
Yeah.
But people don't realize, like, I mean, legitimately, the first generation kids, like, that's who I'm That's who I look at now, the first generation South Asians that are here.
Right.
Because those are the
kids
that...
Your first generation. I'm an immigrant. Well. I'm an immigrant. Yeah.
I'm first generation, but I have no kids. But it's a first generation with kids. Like, I watch, you know, my friends that have kids now, and none of them are emotionally traumatizing to their children. Like, unfortunately, our parents were. Because, and this is... I'm not knocking anybody's family, but legitimately... People back then didn't know any better. And it sounds stupid to say, because you can go, well, of course, you know not to beat a kid.
Right.
But when you grew up in a system where your teachers could beat you.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like, you could go to elementary school and
get hit,
pass a note to the kid next to you, and you can get beaten by your teacher. And that's okay with your parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, my mother suffered from, she didn't know it, but she had PTSD, and she had anxiety and manic depression. And I mean, she was in the war between India and Pakistan, saw some horrific, horrific shit, and never did therapy because therapy was for pussies.
That's right. That's right. Well, you have to be crazy. You have to be crazy to go to therapy.
Or it's an embarrassment to you. Like, what? That's right. Like, what are people going to say outside?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, my son isn't there?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, what are people going to say?
Yeah.
My kid's in therapy? Like, what? They're going to think you're crazy. And then they put this one. This is the one that which never affected me because I didn't buy the bullshit anyway.
Yeah.
Well, nobody's going to want to marry you.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's interesting.
If they find out you're crazy, who's going to want to marry you?
But do you think that maybe it was like less effective to you when she would say about the marriage part, mainly because you're a guy? I think for women, it's a little different than it is for a guy.
Well, I knew from probably 11 or 12 that I wanted nothing to do with arranged marriages.
Right.
Just because it's so wildly, wildly unfair to the woman involved.
Yeah.
In it, because it's... And it's so, I proposed this when I was doing stand-up in India, and it was met very well by women, and it was not well-received by men.
Of course not.
And I was like, let's do it the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have the girl pick from, you know, the pictures and go house to house and turn down these boys.
Yeah.
And see what that does to their fucking self-esteem and to their self-worth.
That's right. That's right.
When it's something as simple, like, I remember that they were looking for my biological brother, who I don't really consider a family at all. But
yeah,
but this is ages ago when they were trying to do an arranged marriage for him. We were in India. And I mean, it was like, well, she made these samosas herself.
Wow. You know, you're selling like point, dude.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to sell this in any way they can. I'm like, she's not a fucking Chevy.
That's right.
Like, you're putting the hardcore sell on this.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, she made the rice herself. She made this and she made that. And she knows how to cook and she'll clean. I'm like, we're not hiring a caterer or a cleaning lady.
But that's what you're hiring, though. That's culturally, traditionally, that has been the role of the woman, right?
Yeah. And so I'm sitting there. My brother hadn't, you know, my biological brother hadn't come in yet. And so they're like, do you have any questions for her?
Oh.
And I said, no. And they're like, legitimately, do you have any questions for her? And I go, yeah. And I looked at this girl, beautiful, stunningly beautiful girl.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, I do have a question. And she's all eager to answer. And I go, what's your favorite color? And everybody in the room is just kind of looking around. I go, nobody's asked any questions of substance. Everybody can tell me how good of a cook you are.
That's right.
But like, hey, what's your favorite color? What do you like to do?
That's right.
Do you like sports?
That's right.
Like, I'm just trying to get to know this person on a human level. And it's so funny because my brother was like, no, she's not my type. And the girl's father called my dad, and they're like, you know, we heard your family member conveyed the message that your son is saying that it's not your type, that that's not his type. And our daughter is very pleased to hear that. Oh. And my dad's like, really? We thought she would be a little upset, but okay, it's nice to know that she's taking it well. And he goes, no, she wanted to know if your youngest son was single.
Oh, what's that?
Because I talked to her like a fucking human.
That's right.
You know,
that's
instead of right. I didn't care about a resume.
Yes.
But this is what I'm saying. Like, let's reverse it. And but going back to what you're saying, like, trauma is a real thing that we deal with.
Yes.
And I like, and that's why, you know, you and I hit it off so well is because
we bonded over pain, man.
Yeah. We and I think we do. And it's so different with Indian people, in our audiences, because we'll talk about this. And it's so funny because they try to make it sound like you're the only one that went through it. Like, oh man, that must have been tough growing up.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, if you were just honest with yourself.
That's right.
You realize, I mean, and I'll say this, there's probably that 2% of that Indian parent from back in those days that did it right.
That's right.
like that raise their kids without fear. And
less
without...
than, which is less than 1%, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd give it a solid 2 globally. You know what I mean?
2%.
98% of, like, parents of our generation, like 98% of those guys, because they legitimately didn't know any better. They didn't know they were their kids up, and
That's right. And look, they didn't know any better, right? Like, because they were raised that way, and they just passed it on to their kids, and they were like, that's just how you raise it.
The abused becomes the abuser.
That's right.
Which is a very, which is something that happens in abusive situations.
Sure.
And I learned that, and I think this is where it comes from for the first generation kids.
Yeah.
Is I always said to myself, like, if I ever have kids, I would never do that to a child.
Sure.
Like, I would never, like, you, I mean, and I'm sure you went through the same thing. Like, you could just be loud. Or laughing too hard, or whatever it was, or not like whatever food was served, and you got your ass handed to you.
That's right. That's
so right. So how do you, I mean, what do you do in that situation? There's a few choices that you have. You can sit there and wallow in it.
Yeah.
And it can affect your life and your outcome.
Yeah.
Or you can find a way to turn it around and make it so you can explain what you're going through in a funny way to people that don't understand what it's like to grow up in a South Asian household. Now, I'm not, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot of shit for this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying all South Asian households are like this.
That's right. That's
right. I'm just saying yours and I was.
That's correct.
And I've talked to people that were like, yeah, man, that situation was similar to me.
That's correct. And, you know, I've spoken to so many South Asian, like, friends who are not even comedians, and they'll talk about their trauma. I mean, look, Raj, you and I have known each other for a while now. And, it's taken me, like, 10 years to work up the courage to get up on stage and talk about how my dad used to beat the shit out of me till I was 15. Like, as a girl, like, a girl getting beaten up by a father, like, that's the first man in your life as a girl. And if that's your impression of men, then every person, every man, intimate man that you're going to have in your life after that, it's probably going to be a version of that, because that's all you know. And for me, it's like I have 4 older brothers on top of that. And, you know, when I moved here, and I don't think we've ever talked about this, but when I moved here, my brothers were quite abusive. I mean, one day my brother started beating the shit out of me so badly, I had to call the cops on him, because that was the only way to stop him, you know? Yeah. And my parents, who were living in Pakistan at the time, would, like, literally call me, and, you know, and he was such a coward, he would call my parents up and be like, she's calling the cops on me.
Yeah.
And my parents would be like, my mom would immediately be like, you have to swear on the Quran, you're not going to press charges against him.
Yeah,
I mean, the enabling, the enabling of it is so crazy. Yeah. But you know what it is? It's like when I talk about it on stage, or when I talk about it, you know, they see people look at me as if, like, I'm the only, like, weird anomaly that's happening to, or as if I'm lying or making it up to get attention, which is none of the fucking things. I mean, do you experience that? Do you have, like South Asian folks walk up to you after, or if you're talking about trauma, whatever, walk up to you and they're like, oh, is that really true?
It's only happened to me in Texas, where I've had people that were at shows that knew my parents.
Mm.
And they were like, well, I know that that's made up, because they could never do that. I was like, yeah, because the people that you play Timpati with aren't kicking your ass. The people that you're playing cards with every Friday night, when you lose a hand of cards, are not beating the shit out of you.
That's right.
But you don't know what happens when the door shuts.
That's
right. You know what I mean? Like I said, like, I'll give you a very, very cool example of this. Mm. My mother came out to a show. I think it was the last show before she passed that she came to see. She brought like 16, 17 of her girlfriends with her. They all sat in the middle. It was at the Addison Improv. And I'm headlining, and I was doing a joke about getting beat as a child.
Mm.
And I said, excuse me, I go, if you don't believe me that my mom used to beat the shit out of me, she's right here. And I pointed at her. She stands up, all 5'3" of her, stands up and waves to the audience and goes, I used to beat him.
Oh, my God.
And it got such an applause break that I had to end the show. I was closing anyway.
Right.
And I was like, I can't follow that, so I'm just going to end the show. And we went home. I was living on my own. I was living in Addison.
Yeah.
And I went back to our family house. And my mother was sitting there. She's like, the show was so great. She's like, but why do you say that I used to beat you? And I was like, because you did.
Right.
She goes, that none of what you said tonight was true. And I go, how? I go, I was specifically about getting beat by an extension cord. And She goes, none of that was true. I said, Mom, I can walk into the garage right now and I can tell you where it's hung up. Wow. I know exactly which extension cord it is.
Right.
And we brought up everything from the past and I left. I went back to my place and the next day I came over to have lunch and my mother is sitting in the same spot wearing the same clothes from the night before.
Whoa.
And she's like, I haven't slept. And I was like, really? She's like, I've just been thinking about everything that you said.
Mm.
I said, okay. She goes, I completely blacked it out.
Wow.
She's like, I sat here last night and it all came back.
Wow.
She goes, what I did to you was so horrific and so unfair. And she, and you know this in our culture, she touched my feet.
Whoa. Mothers
and she
never
goes,
do
if
that.
I ever, she goes, if I ever hurt you, I'm begging for your forgiveness. And I go, that's all I wanted was a sorry. Wow. I didn't want any sort of like, you know, public whatever.
Sure.
Just a personal, hey, I'm really sorry I did that.
Sure.
Luckily for me, in that rare situation, I got it. And
closure.
We had
you got closure. Huge
we
closure.
Did. And we had the best relationship after that for years and years and years. And then unfortunately, about 5 or 6 years later, she was diagnosed with cancer, and 15 months later, she passed.
Yeah.
But for the 6 years after that day where she said she was sorry, was the best 6 years I ever hung out with my mom because I didn't want – I mean, I remember going off to college and making it on purpose. Like, I'm going 3.5-4 hours away.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't come home. Like, my dad would call me, like, your mom wants to know when you're coming home for a Christmas break. I'm like, yeah, I'm staying here.
Yeah.
And I would stay for Christmas break. I would stay for summers. I just didn't come home because I'm like, I don't want to go back there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because but it is, I mean, I did therapy for years and it saved my life. I can say that because
the
I was having such insane anxiety and anxiety disorder and panic attacks.
Yeah.
That I'm like, and this is how it is. And this is not a racist thing to say. But when you say panic attacks, you tell other Indian people or South Asians, they're like, that's a white people thing.
Yeah, they do.
My best friend.
It's ignorance, man. But it's ignorance. Don't you think that's ignorance? What is that? Is that denial?
They just don't know. Like, I remember telling my friend Avi that I was having a panic attack while I was at his house.
Mm.
He's like, your hands are shaking. I was like, give me a few minutes. I'm having a panic attack.
Oh.
He goes, that's some Tony Soprano shit. Is that? He's like, he didn't think that was real. He thought it was a thing made up for the TV show The Sopranos.
Wow.
And I was like, no. I legitimately have anxiety disorder.
Sure.
And I have no shame. My inner child knows when to cry for help.
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
I had no qualms when I was in Vegas, which is funny because that's where you are. The first time I had an actual massive panic attack.
Wow.
Thought I was having a heart attack. I was staying at the Mirage.
Yeah.
I was staying at Caesars. And I thought I was having a heart attack. I got in a cab because I refused the paramedics that came to my room. I refused to go in the ambulance with them. I made this poor cab driver run every red light in Vegas to get to UNLV emergency room.
Wow.
And that's when the nurse was like, your EKG is normal. Your blood pressure is a little high,
mm-hmm.
but what you're having is a panic attack.
Yeah.
And I immediately reached out to the Laugh Factory, which we're so blessed in the sense that Jamie Masada and the Laugh Factory have a full-time psychiatrist on staff at the club.
Which
and
is great.
For any comic, you don't have to be a regular at the club or pastor. Any comic that wants mental health, your first 6 sessions of therapy are free.
Wow.
And I remember that next day after I slept, because I'd stayed up all night with this horrible panic attack.
Mm.
I slept that day, and the first thing I did was email the club. And I said, I'd like to meet Dr. Tabori and set up an appointment for therapy. And the first thing, she goes, what would have triggered your panic attack? And I go, I have no idea. My mom died a few months ago.
Hmm.
And she's like, well, let's start there.
Right?
And we went back and we started talking about the level of abuse that was in that house.
Sure.
And by today's scale, you know, it would be criminal.
Yeah, for sure.
But back then, like, people didn't, you know, people didn't give a shit.
That's right. That's
because,
right.
you know, like my mother, again, with the PTSD, when there was a movie that came out and it's a Bollywood movie called Border. And as a family, we went to go see it. And when the war scene started, because she was 7 years old in the war between India and Pakistan. When the war scene started, she got up and left.
Wow.
Till this day, she'll tell you, like, if she was here, she would tell you she never saw that movie.
Wow. Wow.
And we were there. We were all in the theater. And the war scene started. And she got up and walked out. And she doesn't remember ever being at that movie.
Jesus.
Because the war scene started and it she just blocked everything out.
That's right. That's her survival. That's her survival mechanism, man.
Yeah. And that's what happened. So that's when I realized, like, oh, there's something wrong with mom.
Sure.
I mean, granted, we were adults by this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, you can't go to school and, you know, tell your friends that what's going on in your house. So you do a couple of things. You make people laugh.
Yes.
Or you write really sad fucking poetry.
That's right.
And I decided to make people laugh.
No, listen, and thank God for that, right? I mean, I feel like in our culture, like, you're not even supposed to go and talk about your problems to people because you know, that means that people will look down upon you and that you have problems. And God forbid if you have problems because you couldn't.
I was doing a show in Mumbai and the girl that was doing a guest spot.
Yeah.
She went up in her 5 minutes that she was doing was all about her and her therapist. And I remember watching from the wings and I'm like, the balls on this girl, this is great. People need to hear this because this is ballsy shit for over there.
For sure.
And I remember looking at the audience that wasn't getting it.
Wow.
Like, the jokes were funny. They just weren't getting it because it hit me. They don't know what the fuck a therapist is.
That's correct. It's not part of the culture.
No, I mean, can you imagine like going like that's what you want to be in India? Like, you know what? I'm going to help people. I'm going to go to college, I'm going to go to med school, and I'm going to be a therapist. And then you open your first office, and then nobody shows up.
Right. They're like, we are perfect. I told my mom, I recently was talking to my mom about a year and a half. You've met my mom. And I said to my mom, I said, Mom, you've grown up with a lot of trauma. You know, my mom just has, you know, grew up with a lot of trauma. Grew up in a very abusive household and just got married off at like 16, 17 years old. I was her fifth child at the age of 23. You know, my two brothers have polio. You know that they got expired vaccination in Pakistan. And that, you know, and that my parents just had the most tumultuous marriage, that my father was very physically abusive towards her. So she just has a lot of trauma. You know, I said to mom, I said, Mom, you know, a therapy has really significantly helped me. I've been going to therapy for 13, 14 years already. I was like, you should go to therapy. It'll help you. And she was like, first she was like really resistant to the idea. And then she was like, okay, you know, I have this, because she's in Dallas now, right? So she's like, I'm going to go talk to this friend at the mosque. And I'm like, oh, that's great. She's a therapist. I'm like, perfect. So then a few days passed by and I said to my mom, I'm like, Mom, did you talk to your therapist friend? And she's like, I talked to her and she told me that I am perfect.
Yeah, of course.
I was like, of course. What did you say? She's like, she told me I am perfect. And I was like, this is some fucking Adonis shit right here. Like, I was like, you're Adonis?
You know, and you know, at this point, at their age, and this sounds, you know, just between me and the fence post and all the people that are listening.
Yeah.
At this point, fuck it. Let her think she's perfect. As long as you can get you right.
Yes.
That's what I'm focused on. Like, I would have loved to have taken my mom to therapy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she, you know, lost her battle with cancer. But my dad's the same way. Like, you know, he's got congestive heart failure, but he'll tell you he's perfectly fine.
Right.
And I'm like, where does that mindset come from? Your doctor is telling you that with your diet and the way you're with no exercise and your sedentary lifestyle, you're running towards death and you'll laugh at it.
Right.
And I'm like, where does that come from? That just the belief that I'm completely fine and I'm going to be okay is so weird to me. Like, I know when I'm not okay.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm the first one to go, hi, look at me. I'm not well. So how do I fix this? It's like a fucking car. If I took the wheel off your car, you're not going to go, it'll drive fine with three wheels.
That's right. That's right.
But you're like, you know what? I should probably fucking put a wheel on there.
You know? I just feel like it comes from a place of because there was so much struggle for them to probably grow up in like this, you know, look, your parents, I don't know if your parents did, my parents definitely didn't come from, you know, wealthy families by any means. I mean, very poor families. My mom especially came from a very poor family. My dad's side, you know, struggled and ended up building themselves. But I feel like when you come from such dire situations, there's not a lot of room. You're just surviving. There's no room for therapy. Therapy is luxury. That's what like rich people do.
I mean, my mom, so you know that term retail therapy, I think my mom invented that
because retail therapy, awesome. That,
so she grew up very, very wealthy, and then when the war between India and Pakistan happened, they had to flee overnight, and they lost everything, bad business deals, bad land deals when they got to India, and so she went from riches to rags.
Wow.
And then, you know, studied, she was valedictorian of every single year of every. She was valedictorian high school, you know, because they do the examinations every year.
Sure.
She came in first from high school through college, through nursing school, through the SMU, Southern Methodist University nursing program. She was top of her class.
Yeah.
Built her own business, became a millionaire.
Amazing.
And everything she ever bought is still in that house. You can open the door to our garage. It's a 2-car garage.
Yeah.
At their house. You can open the door and step into the garage.
Yeah.
And that's as far as you're going to get. It's just packed that deep with
everything. Wow.
And then you pull down the door for the attic and the attic is full.
Wow.
And then her old closet is full.
Wow.
And because her logic was,
yeah,
well, if we ever go poor again, I can sell all this stuff and we can
that's
be fine.
That's right. That's where exactly where that comes from.
So she became an emotional hoarder.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's what she did. So that's how she coped.
Yes.
Well, I didn't really have that. So it was, I always just got, I was bullied as a kid as well.
Mm. Because of being an Indian?
Yeah, being Indian in a small Texas town and, you know, there's strength in numbers and we were the only Indian family.
Right.
So it was real. We were just easy target.
Sure.
And I learned to make my bullies laugh because it takes a very special kind of asshole to punch somebody when you're giggling.
That's right. That's right.
So I just learned that early on. And the joy, and this sounds very cliche, especially in our business, but the sheer joy I get from entertaining people and making them laugh, there's not a price you can put on that. And if I won the lottery tomorrow and they said, you can do stand-up comedy all over the world, but we're not going to pay you a dime.
Yeah.
Would you do it? And I would say gladly.
Yep. Absolutely.
I used to say this to my mother because, you know, Indian, South Asian moms, especially like, oh, what are you going to do as a comedian? What am I going to tell my friends? Everybody's kids are doctors and lawyers. You want me to tell them my son's a comedian? And I'd go, I'd rather be a comedian and live in a dumpster
than
be a doctor and live in a mansion.
That's right. Because
I know. I know one would make me so miserable that I would put a gun in my mouth, and the other one would make me so happy I could keep going.
That's right. So
that's what it was. I just I love making people laugh. If it's one-on-one or if it's, you know, a theater of 3,000 people, it doesn't matter.
That's right.
It's just the sheer joy I get from that. And so I'm thankful in a weird way. I'm thankful for that abuse and that bullying.
Yeah.
That got me to here. And it sounds very weird to say thank you. You know, like,
the bullies?
I'm so glad that happened, because if it didn't, I always wonder, like, how unfunny would I be?
you know what I mean? It's funny because...
I have friends that grew up in very well-adjusted households, and I'm like, you fuckers aren't funny.
They're so boring.
Yeah, I mean, they're not... they're just... They laugh at, like, that, like old dad jokes. I'm like, come on, man. Like, you're 2 years, 5 years younger than me. Stop laughing at that shit.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, you grew up well-adjusted.
That's exactly. You grew up healthy. Is that
what you mean? Yeah, you grew up with parents that told you that they loved you.
Right. That's right.
That's why you're not funny.
Dude, I'm the first person in my family to start saying I love you. And my family
was
awkward and weird about it when I would say it. And they'll be like, oh, I love what? And now it's become part of their vernacular to be like, oh, I love you too. I love you. Next,
yeah.
You know, for a culture that really invented the Kama Sutra, for a culture that has Bollywood movies that are all about rom-coms, and we really are fucking anti-love, tell you, that are expressing that form of love, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. Like, I find it oddly amusing that we did come up with the Kama Sutra. We have 1.3 billion people.
Right? Somebody's fucking, tell you that much.
But, yeah, you can't kiss in a Bollywood movie.
That's right.
We cannot show that. I'm like, well, I mean, there's one point. I don't think they need it. I think they figured it out before the kissing in the Bollywood movie.
That is very true.
I think they figured fucking out.
We put the French to shame, baby.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it was always like, you remember our old school movies, like the guy and the girl be like running around the tree and they get really close. And the next thing you see is like a bee pollinating a flower.
That's correct.
And then like fireworks are going off. You're like, somebody's fucking.
That's
like,
right.
He figured it out. Like,
that's right.
It's not, I mean, it wasn't like, thanks. I got thanks for the Dakota ring. I figured it out. Like, I know what they're doing.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I mean, I was walking my dog. And, you know, that's how I write, like, that's how where my material comes from, is when I'm on my walk with my dog.
Oh, really?
Like,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's no one, I'm, you know, my wife is at work, and
yeah.
I walk the dog during the day, and all I have is time to think.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up, and there was one family where the husband and wife were publicly affectionate.
Okay.
They were friends with my parents.
Okay.
And man, the shit talking that happened when those people left.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because they, like, the wife would tell her husband, like, we'd be sitting there having like a dinner party. And she's like, you know, honey, can I get you something else? And I'm like, did she just call him honey?
Oh.
At the dinner table? Slut. Like, you know, like, in my head, I was like, who do, we don't do this. We don't say honey.
That's right.
And she would come up, like, they would be, like, the men would be talking, and she would go behind her husband of 20 plus years and just give him a hug from behind and bring him another beer or whatever and be like, honey, can I get you anything else? And kiss him on his cheek and go, I love you. And he'd be like, I love you too, hon. And then the men would just go back to talk, and the look on their faces.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that was always so amazing to me, is when I would go to my, especially like my friends that were American, like, because people don't realize this, and you know this, and I know this.
Yeah.
You live in two different worlds when you move to America. Like, when
that's
you,
correct.
Like, for you, you were in school all day, and you guys moved to New York first, right?
We used to live in Jersey City.
So you would go to school with all the kids in Jersey, and you're a kid from Jersey.
That's right.
And then you would go home. The minute that door shut, you're in fucking Pakistan again.
That's correct. That's exactly where you are.
And people don't realize the split personality of our lives.
That's correct.
Is I would go to school with the Bretts and the Marlins and the Mikes of the world.
Yeah.
And then when I got home and that door shut, I was in Delhi.
That's correct.
You know, I was in New Delhi.
That's correct. I mean, you know what I mean?
And so I would see, like, you know, guys, you know, my age, because I started school early, like guys a couple years older than me, and they have girlfriends, and, you know, we're in middle school, and they're holding hands with a girl. I'm like, what?
I didn't know
we could do this, because those people at home, the ones that gave me life, they don't seem to fucking like each other.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
And so I'm like, holding hands is not a thing, and saying I love you wasn't a thing.
That's right.
And it wasn't until, I was the same way. I would tell my parents, I was like, you know, God, I love you guys. I'll see you soon. Especially when I'd go off to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mom was very quick to, like, one-on-one, if nobody else was there, to tell you that she loved you.
Wow. Wow.
So when I would be leaving for school, she would always walk outside and give me a hug and go, I love you. Call me when you get to your apartment.
Okay. Wow.
But, like, in general, that just wasn't
a something thing. To express.
And it's love and affection and... I never saw till this day. They were married almost 40 years when she passed. I never saw them exchange a kiss on the cheek.
Ever?
Never.
That's interesting.
I remember at their 25th anniversary, we got them to dance, and it looked like a game show where we picked two random people out of the audience and then forced them to dance together.
Yeah.
Because that's just how awkward it looked.
And that's
I was like,
correct.
Oh, you guys, okay.
Yeah.
But it was never, and I know they loved each other.
Yes.
You know, I don't think they liked each other. I think they loved each other. I don't think they,
which are two different things. I think a lot of people don't understand that. I mean, I agree with you on that. My parents, I'm not so sure even if my parents loved each other.
I think my dad was in love with my mother. I don't think my mother was ever in love with my father. But
did your parents have love marriage though? Did they have
love? No, I mean, kind of.
Okay.
They met in London, and it was, you know, my dad fell in love with her.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where, like, her friends were like, come on, you're 36.
Wow. Yeah. Like,
which was in those days, which my mom didn't want to get married.
Wow.
But in those days, it was like, hey,
right,
you're getting up there.
What a trailblazer, by the way.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
36 that time?
Oh, when I was born, my dad was 40 and my mom was 30. My dad was 41.
Yeah.
And yeah, my mom was 37, somewhere in there.
Wow. Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it was 30. I think they got married 33, 37 is when they actually got married. But yeah, she was 33. Sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things. Like, she's like, I don't want to get married. He's a very nice man. But
yeah.
And then finally it was like, hey, come on. And you need to settle down. And she's like, okay, well, then I'm going to marry him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was that. But I don't think there was. I never saw it. I never saw them hug. I never saw a thing. And so any girl that I had ever dated was like, why are you not big on public displays of affection?
That's right.
And I'm like, because I would, and this is what I'm saying, the dichotomy. Like, I would go to my buddy Brett's house, who was three doors down, and Gail and Gary were their parents.
Yeah.
Or Brett and Lisa's parents. And I remember sitting there, you know, just bullshitting with them in the living room, and Gail just walk over and give Gary a little kiss on the lips and go into the bedroom and get whatever and And you know, it was time for dinner. And I'm like, what in the fuck? Did she just kiss him right there?
In front of me? People? Yes.
Like, I was embarrassed. As a child, I was like, "How? I'm here. How could you do that in front of me? My parents have never done that. And they're my parents. I'm watching your parents make out."
That's right.
And I was like, oh, that.
Second, your voice. I lost your volume there for a second. Okay, there you are. Go ahead. Oh. Roger, hang on one second. I don't know why I lost your volume. Travis? There you are. Okay.
Am I back?
Yeah, you're back. You're back. Sorry.
But we technically grow up like abnormal or whatever in the sense that...
Dude, that abnormal is normal to us, right?
That's what I'm saying.
It's not so, until like, we come to anything, the West. Yeah.
Yeah, seeing anything that was... related to like love and affection, and that's why I do the joke on stage. Is like, well, like South Asians, we grow up with like kids that grew up here grow up with love, support, and understanding.
Yeah, that's right.
And we grow
that's
up with
joke.
Fear, beatings, and fear.
That's exactly it. And that's considered that's supposed to be love, by the way.
Yeah, they used to say, "What's the maka go so maka
piaruta?"
Exactly. And I'm
exactly.
Like, well, I'd rather you hate me then.
That's exactly what it is.
You know what I mean, because your way of showing love hurts.
That's correct. A lot, like physically, emotionally.
Yeah, emotionally.
I'm having fucking panic attacks as an adult, like before I go on stage. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was the only thing. Like, I remember having panic attacks, and the only thing that would save me was going on stage.
Wow.
Because I mean, multiple times, Mona, I was walking on stage, literally in the midst of a horrible panic attack.
Wow.
And the first applause break or laugh would happen, and I'd forget about it, and it'd go away. So when I first started getting the panic attacks, there was about a 2.5 year window there where I booked literally every show every night of the week. Wow. If I could literally, but before that, all day long, I would just be wrapped up in a blanket on my couch and go, this is where they're going to find my body.
Wow.
Like that's where my mind was.
Wow.
And the thing was stand-up comedy saved me and therapy saved me and realizing that we did grow up abnormal, but that's it's okay right. Because fucking shit happens.
That's right. Shit happens.
Yeah, you can't pick where you grow up and what house you're in.
I agree. I mean, I just feel like, you know, just like you just said, like for me, therapy and stand-up comedy for sure saved my life. I don't think we've ever talked about this. When I moved out at 15 from Pakistan and I moved to Jersey and I used to live with my family, There was just so much trauma and so much pain in the family where I didn't know how to process it, and you have no one to talk to. So this is going to get very dark. But when I was a senior in high school, I tried to kill myself. And and they ended up locking me in a psychiatric ward, right? And my family came. My mom came. My father was in Pakistan because he never really lived here. My mom was there, and my brothers came to visit me behind all these closed doors. And I remember just sitting there with like shame, just so much shame, you know, just with my
and guilt and
so much guilt, so much shame. And like I'm looking down and my mom was sitting there and she's, you know, and she looks at me and she's like, how could you do this to me?
Yeah. Yeah.
How could you do this to you? Like, do you understand like where the fuck we are right now? Like we're in a psychiatric ward where your daughter is locked up because she tried to commit suicide. Right.
Yeah.
But you're making it about yourself because you also have unresolved trauma that hasn't been resolved. So you're making it as if this is about you, but this has nothing to do with you. This is just everything about me. And I think for me, it was such a light bulb that went off in my head. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm not fucked up. I'm just around fucked up people.
You're a product of fucked up.
I'm a product of fucked up. So what I need to do is unfuck myself. Is to right? I need to.
Hashtag unfuck yourself.
Hashtag unfuck yourself all fucking day, dude.
That is your my new mantra. T-shirt that you're gonna sell.
Hashtag unfuck yourself. Desi
hashtag
style.
Unfuck yourself.
Unfuck, dude. I think we as adults, especially when you come from this kind of background, this kind of trauma, you for the rest of your adult life, all you're doing is unfucking yourself.
Yeah, and I'm gonna share this with you, and I've never shared this with therapy or my wife or anybody. You were very candid enough to talk about it. I remember distinctly, I think I was 13, maybe almost 14. And we, so our house in Dallas is a two-story house, and there's a half bathroom downstairs next to the formal dining room. And I remember distinctly with a knife in the bathroom. And I'm like, we could, nobody was home.
Yeah.
It was after school. Latchkey kids, man.
Yeah.
You know, came home, had a key to the house. My brother wasn't home from school yet. My parents were working.
Yeah.
And I just remember, and this is, like I said, I know my inner crybaby. Because I was like, man, we could just get out of this situation now.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing was, there were two things. One was like, let's not and get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Like when we hit 18 and it's time to go to college, let's get the fuck out and not look back.
Sure.
And the other one was, how bad is this going to hurt if I do it?
Mm.
Like if I cut my, like, I was like, cause I mean, I'll turn into a little bitch. I'm not scared to admit it. I'm like, how bad is it going to hurt?
I don't know if that's being a bitch. I think that's more being, that's the sane side of you.
Sure, for sure.
Coming but to inside, your rescue.
Inside my head, I'm like, that's what you're like, man, it's going to hurt. You know what I mean? But I also was really keen on, I knew at 12 or 13 that I wanted to get out of that little town.
Sure.
And away from that house.
Sure.
And just live my life the way I want to live it. And that's why, you know, I was pre-med in college, as we all do. And I changed my major. I was at the end of my junior year. And I called my father and I was like, I don't want to be a doctor. And he's like, you're going to break your mother's heart. What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
I go, I want to be an actor. And I finished with fine arts degree.
Wow.
Because that's
how,
what
how did your family receive that when you said that
my
to your dad?
Cried.
Your mother cried. How about your dad?
My dad, I think deep down inside, if you could have given him two options in India, and that was one, to be a CPA, which he was, or to be a Bollywood actor and singer, playback singer, he would have taken the latter.
Wow.
He would have been an actor and singer. He was the first, person to ever, show Indian movies in Dallas.
Wow.
He would call the production houses in India. He'd get the reel sent from Mumbai. There was the University of Texas in Dallas. He rented out their lecture hall.
Yeah.
Because it was $50. I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
It was $50 and it came with the projector.
Wow. Wow.
And so he charged $2 a ticket.
Yeah.
And it was a dollar for tea and a $1.50 for samosas.
I love that.
And he went to the stores. He made the tea himself. He had a lady that made the samosas for all the Indian stores. And he had her do it. And he would warm them up himself.
Yeah.
He would cut the tickets. And he was the movie guy. He was the guy who would put it on the reel, run it through the projector. And that, I think, if you were to give him that opportunity again to show movies and have his radio show that he had for 8 years, which I was his co-host.
Yeah.
As a kid, if I said, let me take away the millions of dollars you made as a businessman, but I'll give you these movies and the radio show, he would give you every penny.
Does that break your heart when you think about that?
Yeah, because I get to do this.
Yeah.
And he never got to do that.
Yeah.
And so that whole, like, I'm going to come to this country and give my kids a better life.
Yeah.
Came with those options. And yeah. I don't think that. You know, and they saw, like, I remember in the beginning, my mom's like, what am I going to tell people? You know, Lokya King, what are we going to tell people?
Right.
And then it started, as soon as I started getting any sort of success,
yes,
I knew that it was okay, because I remember one time I went to their house, and the glass coffee table they had in the living room just had all the magazines that I was in, all the newspapers.
Wow.
And my special was playing on loop on their DVD player.
Oh,
and I was like,
so
what's going on? He's like, oh, people are coming over for cards tonight. And I go, oh, so what that was for is when they got there and like, hey, how's Raj doing? She can, like, point to the table and, like, hand them all a magazine and go, you can read. And the special's on the back. I was like, okay, so there's those moments where I'm like, okay, I know you guys are proud of what I'm doing. But
right.
It wasn't really, really ever vocalized.
Yes, yes.
Not that often. It may be one or two times. But,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's I knew I wanted – so that's the main reason I never physically harmed myself in that sense.
Thank God for that.
Even though in my head I was like, man, it'll just be a second. It might hurt, but then it's done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, or we can get the fuck out of here and live the life that we want to live. And that's what I did.
And thank God for that. And I'm glad you did that. And thank God I got out of the psychiatric ward, although I did meet a lot of assholes after that. But here we are.
But you know, I love the fact that we're both South Asian.
Yes.
Both comedians and both advocating for mental wellness and therapy.
Listen, man, I mean, I'm just such a huge mental health advocate. About 2.5 months ago, Forbes ran this article and they included me as part of
Covenant. Forbes, and who just had another article come through last week.
Another article on Forbes. What's up, people? And this one was more about gender bias and sexual harassment.
I had spoken
to you about that situation where a South Asian male comic walked up to me and called me a whore to my face, which was fascinating. They're going to be.
Hey, man, whores get paid.
Whores do get paid. And you know what it is? It also takes a whore to know a whore. You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
That's also a thing. But their name is going to be exposed in very, very due time. So they need to...
Oh, did you put them in the article? Because I didn't read the whole thing.
Well, they're not part of the article. There's going to be a huge post about them because this is a... You know, here's my thing, okay, Raj?
I can't believe who... Because I know who it is.
You know this.
So uncharacteristic.
This is so... Like, this person is just such a piece of garbage. There's no really other way to describe them. But... this is what I really want to ask you this question. You're a South Asian male comic, right? So we're minorities, right? You know, male, female, South Asian, and we're the minorities. We're the new kids on the block, right?
Yeah.
Now with this whole Me Too movement and Women's March just happened this past weekend and, you know, the Time's Up movement. I mean, so many more women are vocal about, you know, their horrible experiences that they've had with men. Now, when I listen to a person like you, who is South Asian male comedian and who's so about female empowerment and what you said earlier in the podcast about, hey, let's reverse the roles and arrange marriages and see how the fuck that works out, right? And I love that so much too.
Yeah.
And we want more men like you because we can't do it on our own, right? We need allies like you to come kind of help change the narrative and help change people's minds. My question to you is, like, to me, what fascinates me is that if you are a minority of any background, I suppose, or especially in our culture, because it's so deep, the patriarchy is so deep rooted in our cultures that.
Yeah.
When you come out, and if you're an American born and raised person, and then you come out and make a comment like that, do you think is that culture and family playing a role, or is that just culture playing a role? Like, what do you think that is?
I think with your specific situation, because we talked about this at the last Minority Report.
That's right.
And you know, when I'm in town and when I'm available, I've never turned you down for hosting.
I love you for it,
because I get to see. Such amazingly talented, funny women, yourself included, and the lineups that you pick and the people that you put on those shows are just so good and such a refreshing voice. So we need more of it. I think with you, my friend, and this is all praises to you in the sense that you came onto the scene a relatively unknown person.
Yep.
Who rocked up onto the LA scene, and specifically, you didn't go to the more PC Bay Area. You didn't go to the more easily accepting East Coast, New York, Jersey, Philly, DC, which would have been an easier move for you, honestly.
Yeah.
You rocked up on Sunset Boulevard and started kicking indoors. And I think there's a jealousy factor that comes with these guys that are like, you know, why the only reason she's getting this is she fucked her way to the top, which you didn't. Or she's a chick, or she's this. And at the end of the day, you prove not only to myself, because I love watching you work. Funny is funny. It doesn't matter what you're fucking. If you have a dick between your legs.
That's right.
It's if you're funny. And when you have comics, regardless of background, socioeconomics, whatever. When you have guys who are watching you speak your truth, which is and tell your fans and tell your people that are listening how often you get death threats for this stuff that you talk about.
I do get death threats.
People don't realize this. And I didn't. Man, you would say, I remember back in the day, you're like, yeah, man, I get these fucking death threats every day. And she would say this like it was like going to the water cooler to get water. Like, I'm going to go get death threats. You guys want anything? I'm like, what? Are you getting donuts? No,
just getting death threats. Just another death threat. Just another day.
And then you showed me on, I can't remember what platform it was. You showed me like all the shit that was being said. And like people are like, if you come to Pakistan, we'll burn you alive.
That's
we'll
right.
do this. And you were laughing your ass off reading these.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's fucking balls. It doesn't matter if you're a girl or a guy. That's fucking ballsy. And that shows that you're putting, that the stone that you threw in that pond created more than a ripple. So when you have guys telling you shit like this, that I can't believe it was who it was and what they said, because it's so uncharacteristic of that person that I know. It comes from, it's a jealousy factor.
Sure.
And then I think second, maybe even a close third, will be a cultural issue. But before that, it's a jealousy. Why are you getting the work? Why are you getting, this motherfucker's never been in Forbes.
That's
like,
right.
I've never been in Forbes.
We need to get you in Forbes, man.
I don't think Forbes takes dick jokes. I think that's just.
Slinging dick jokes. They're loving my dick jokes. We need to make them more accepting of your dick jokes.
But there's two ways to react to it. Like, I saw your post, like, hey, I just wrote this article for Forbes. And I could have gone, as if I were him, gone, that bitch.
Yeah.
Or I can go, hey, my friend got a fucking article. Let me read this.
Yeah.
And I chose the opposite of what that guy chose to do. So. Anytime,
because you're also a better person, that's why.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you. But anytime somebody calls you a whore to your face, hug them and say thanks. Because that's all that's doing is giving you drive. Because after that day, and you told me that at the Sherman Oaks, that art gallery, I don't think I've ever seen you hustle harder.
Yeah,
that's when you started putting the Vegas thing together. That's when you started putting more shows together.
Yeah,
that's when you started writing more. That's when you started doing the articles. And I'm like, hey, man, one dude can do this. Imagine when she has 20 guys calling her a whore to her face. She's going to have her own fucking sitcom.
Oh, my God. Listen, not that I want to encourage them to come out and call me a whore to my face, but
hey, assholes don't need encouragement. They find their ways onto the scene.
Exactly. I mean, you know what it is? I think, I know that white guys are getting a lot of bad rep recently, but, there's a lot of talk about white guys being, patriarchy and toxic patriarchy and misogyny. But when you hear it from somebody of your own background who is American-born and raised, that's the kind of stuff that really fucks with your head, where you're just like, I don't understand. And I think for you, and another conclusion that I reached after kind of deciphering and just kind of taking myself out of the emotional part and just kind of looking at it objectively, to me, it also said that this person has said this to another woman before and gotten away with it, or has said it to multiple women, and nobody's ever stood up to him because he's a bully. So he's never had somebody come out and fuck him up. And I'm just going to say he fucked with the wrong whore, tell you that much. Because this motherfucker's going to get knocked the fuck out. Because I'm going to fucking go UFC on his ass.
Good, good. And I'm glad. But I think what happens is there's a lot. I mean, here's the thing. And you can attest to this. And I'm sure a lot of the people that will watch this will send me some hateful shit. But there's no one worse to an Indian or a South Asian. Yeah. There is no one in the world worse to a South Asian than a South Asian.
Yeah, 100%.
If you wonder how the British ruled India for 450 years.
Divide and conquer, baby.
It's divide and conquer in the sense that, just keep this in mind, this is a phenomenal number.
Yeah.
That when the British ruled India, there were 390 million Indians.
Mm-hmm.
There were 130,000 British soldiers. 130,000 people ruled over 390 million because they split us up and they turned us against each other. And it was so easy to do.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, there's no one worse to a South Asian than a South Asian.
Amen.
And now look what we've done between India and Pakistan.
That's right.
Now it's always about a war. It's always about fucking partition. It's always fucking get over it.
That's right. That's right.
But that's what we've done. So when you tell me that a South Asian came to you and said awful shit to your face, I'm like, ballsy, because normally they do it behind your back.
He's just stepping his game up, is what he's trying to do.
But... No, I mean, honestly, I was just like, wow, to your face he said it?
Yeah.
I don't even remember when he like, and he said this, I was like, to your face? Wow, because normally that's just done when you leave the room, and they're like, oh, that fucking whore.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, ballsy, he actually upped his game by saying it to your face.
Yeah, I mean, look, he sucks on stage, so he's gotta come through somewhere. So off stage, that's how he's trying to come through.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. That's where it comes from, is the jealousy and the, hey, man, you're doing what you do. I don't see him with a podcast, and I don't see him with articles in Forbes, and I don't see him booking shows, and I don't see his face on the marquees. But you
know where you do see him is eating shit on stage in India.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. Globally, I've seen it. I've seen it internationally.
Eat stage.
Yeah, I've seen it internationally.
Just eating shit on stage.
Yeah. So, just amazing. Keep doing you. Just
thanks,
keep doing
man.
The thing
I
that
appreciate
you do.
That. We're gonna start wrapping up. What projects you working on? You got some good stuff going on. Performances coming up. What you got going?
Yeah, I'll be February 25th to the 1st. I'm at the Laugh Factory in Reno, Nevada.
Awesome.
March 11th through the 17th, I'll be at the Improv in Tahoe, South Lake Tahoe, California.
Very nice.
And then February 14th through the 16th, I'm at the Arlington Improv in Arlington, Texas. And then I'm working on, we're pitching next week to a couple of networks, a television show for India.
Love it.
And I'm just trying to hustle like you.
Keeping busy, man. I love it. Listen, that's why we're friends right there, because we're fucking just up in our game with the hustle and everything.
Hey, man, I got to try.
I love it. I love it.
I got a white girl to feed.
You do. Although that white girl does pretty well for herself, too.
She does amazingly well.
Yeah, yeah. She does really well for herself.
She's a fucking baller.
She's a rock star, that one.
Hey, man, she's the rock star. I'm the valet.
You just tell me where
to park the car, sweetie. I'll park the car. Ain't no shame in this game. I'm like, who's the badass? I'm like, her. Ain't no shame in this game. I know my meal ticket when I see it.
I think you're doing just great for yourself. This has been such a fun thing. Do you want to plug your social media, your Twitter?
Oh, it's all the so all you South Asians that are going to send hate mail, send it to at russellpeters.com. And watch Russell's special. It's his new special filmed in Mumbai. It's good. It's everything's at Comedian Raj. So all one word, just Comedian RAJ.
Love it.
And please, once again, before we cut out of here, if you are having issues, especially South Asians, my brothers and sisters, listen to me. If you're having any sort of mental issues or mental health issues, there are therapists that will not tell anybody that you're in therapy, and you don't have to tell anybody either.
The only
thing that's going to happen is people will be able to tell a difference, because you'll change, your spirit will change, your self-esteem will change, your self-worth will change. But there's no reason to harm yourself, and get out there and do what we both did and get into therapy. And you don't have to live the life that that you think you do.
Listen, so, I couldn't have said it any better myself. My friend, Raj, thank you so very much for joining us. This was just so wonderful.
I love you to pieces.
I love you too, man. Thank you so much for everything. This was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah. You got it. I'll talk to you later.
I'll talk to you soon. Oh my God, another amazing episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Mona Sheikh. I'll see you next time.